Okay, so welcome back to the Beit Midrash, and we're learning within the pages in Bava Batra, Masechet Bava Batra, which is the third of the Bavas, the third gate in Masechet, in Tractate Nezikin, in the order of the Mishnah and Gemara called Nezikin, damages, if you will. But why is it in there? Because we said that was where all the laws about building cities, building communities are found. And building cities, building communities are found in these pages of the Gemara. And we're talking about, as we said before, just to get the whole milieu back into our minds, right? That we have the milieu of the rabbis who have Torah, and agricultural tzedakah is pretty nicely outlined, and the whole move towards city life, towards the polis, towards how law within community and within a comparison of between Roman law and the rabbinic law vis-a-vis the people with whom they're closest in contact, how they see it unfolding on the one hand in the Roman legislature and versus that, and sometimes in parallel to that in our own culture, because you have these small city states, if you will, not the same way we think of Sparta, but we have these small metropolises, smaller than that kind of villages or established places where all these laws will come into effect, and some of them will come into effect in certain places and some of them will not come into effect in certain places based on the size or their position geographically. We saw one of those aspects when it came to defense walls. You know, do we really need to build this? Do we not really need to build this? That got into a question for us of, are we dealing with taxes, if you will, absolute obligations? Are we dealing with absolute obligations and taxes that at the same time we think about it in that way, we have to get and break our own idiom that we're talking about absolute taxation. We're talking about legislation that is biblical, that is mitzvot, that is mitzvah-oriented, that these mitzvot are sacred ways of fulfilling our obligations to God and religious commandments, like tzedakah itself is a concept. Of righteous giving and righteousness. And at the same time, we have enough legislatively to make it look as though and make it feel as though we really do have legislation that is enforceable even by officers of the law. So that's kind of the way we have to see this is in its most, you know, dual sense that it's living out righteously, religiously, our yehud, our goal, our fabric of being Balei Tzedakah, the fabric of our tradition, kind of say chai behem and live by them and respect others and see that you have the obligation and sense you have the obligation and live with this notion of obligation simply because you have the obligation, even if at the same time it's an absolute law within community, even if that's the law of the land, if you will. Because if I just live with the notion of following the law, and I don't see it as following and living out my obligations vis-a-vis Torah, I'm not really thinking about the milieu of the rabbis. So that's the milieu we have to get back to. And tonight, we're going to talk about a few questions through these pages that are the central locus of Torah, tzedakah policy, and questions overall about tzedakah and where it fits into our lives and into our city lives and into our rural lives and agricultural lives. We're going to talk about some that are very concrete vis-a-vis the amount of money, but we're also going to talk about some of what I consider to be the policy-making considerations. The first question we're going to deal with is on page 9A2, if you're in the English. So we're on the first side of page 9, if you're following along in the Hebrew, or the Aramaic, or what have you, on page Tet, Aleph. And you're talking about the question, Ibayt Ema Kra. So you're on the line that has the little small Rashi Aleph if you're in the Vilna. Okay. Ibayet Ema Kra. Rav Huna Before he's going to bring a proof text, you go up one little paragraph, and I'm on the left side of the page on 9A2. Just go a few words back if you're in the Vilna. I'm sorry, Amar Rav Huna Bodkin. So go where that little Aleph is if you're following in the Vilna Shas, and go to Huna is the first word on the line, and one word back is Rav. Rav Amar Rav Huna Bodkin Limzonot. We investigate the eligibility of a pauper who asks for food. V'ein Bodkin Lichsut. And we do not investigate the eligibility of an inadequately dressed pauper who asks for clothing. So let's talk about what Rav Huna might be talking about. He's saying that bodkin, you don't need to investigate, and you do need to investigate. So you don't need to investigate if he's asking for clothing. But you do need to investigate if he's asking for food. So, if you look at the Rashi, if you're with me on the Vilna Shas page, and you go to the 12th line, you see the word bodkin. You can just listen in if you don't have exactly the spot. Bodkin limzonot. So I want to know, what does it mean? Im ba'oni, if a poor person comes, v'amar, and says, parnesuni, bodkin shelo yiyeh ramai. If he comes and says, I need you to provide me the resources in order to get food, you check him out, lest he's a crook.
Well, he's not telling the truth.
Well, that's not the sense of Ramai that I know. In other words, it's a little bit clearer in the Rashi about his intentionality.
That's a liar, basically.
It's basically a liar. Yeah. It's a fraud.
What does bodkin mean?
Bodkin means to check.
Inspect.
Or investigate. So, I want to look at this Gemara, as I said, we were going to see some that deal with policy. I want to look at this Gemara as being involved with some of the policy decisions that we have to make as a shul, as tzedakah agencies in the world have to make when it comes to asking questions. So, this Rav Huna lesson is that he thinks when people are asking for mezonot, you have to really check them out. But if they ask for clothing, you don't really. Now, what would be one reason why he might say that?
But it's a person who's inadequately dressed. If they're inadequately dressed,
specifies that he's
okay.
Not the dressed. It's evident.
So,
you can look at the person and tell, you don't have to judge what he's feeling.
So you learn from the idiomatic translation of Art Scroll, if you read that, as I did, that they write in an assumption of certain of the Rishonim who understand the Gemara that way. That we're talking about someone who's standing in front of you and he's inadequately dressed, and therefore you obviously know that if this person who's inadequately dressed comes and says, I need some clothes, help me out, that you don't have to go investigate at all. Right? How come he's not the Ramai? How come the guy who's asking for food, for dollars for food, he's potentially the thief, but the guy who's sitting in front of you dressed as if he's such a pauper isn't the thief? In other words, here's the question the Gemara is asking between Rav Huna and what we're going to see in a minute, Rav Yehuda, who reverses the limud. He reverses the question. How do you really know? And therefore, what do I really have to do? Because in a minute, I'm going to show you how Rav Huna proves his point, and in a minute, we'll see how Rav Yehuda proves his point, but there's obviously a deeper issue here involved. And we have to decide, whose argument makes more sense for the investigation.
Are they asking for food itself or for money for food?
According to Rashi, they're asking, he's asking for money from the fund.
This is very much like we encounter people on the street in New York.
Oh, I think so.
This is pre-food stamps.
Yeah, well, even with food stamps, they run out about 2.5 to 3 weeks in on the individual level or family level on a consistent basis.
And the question is, will the money be used for food or not in New York?
Anywhere, right? If we're convinced that we have a system of discerning what a family's true need really is, then maybe we're going to be able to argue for either one of these. Either one of these directions. We could argue for both, but no one's going to argue for both in our passage. I'm just giving the whole passage away. But I just want you to think about the what it is they're saying, and I want you to think about the meta level here of policy making. Right? As Barry mentioned, we do have food stamps today. So we did try to put a system in that would help a family not have to come back to the well, if you will. Right? But a lot of families who come back to the well, and the reason why we know so much about them is because at the Common Pantry that we support as a community, what we know is that they're coming there with their needs for a bag of groceries and their need to fill out their month because they've run out of a lot of the other supplies and the other stuff that they have. And if they're coming for a bag of groceries from the Common Pantry, by the way, they're not asking for money, right? They're asking for very, very supplies. As if they can't make it to the grocery store, and if they did make it to the grocery store, by the way, I'll just give that away too. We're not really asking at the Common Pantry if they really qualify for food stamps or they don't. They can indicate it based on a caseworker or an inventory that's taken when they come into the system. But you don't see people generally there who look like they're abusing or we feel like they're abusing the system of getting a free bag of groceries. Now, line up to actually hand out checks for $120. Right? And think about it from the sense that if it was about handing out a check for $120, just who might come versus people who come for a bag of groceries. And figure out, like, what way would we have to create in order to check that out, but that would still provide for respecting someone's dignity. So again, I'm bringing us back to this. I think the Gemara is challenging us to think about whether or not systems at all can be established to meet the highest ethical challenge. And the discussion being about which one is the one you have to really check for is really the discussion of some people, I think, might be good systems thinkers when it comes to checking for these needs. And some people are probably better at thinking about systems that are better for those needs, as opposed to just saying we've got to figure out which one. So I think the Gemara is trying to do. You can tell me if you think that fits in anywhere here or you have a different read of what the whole discussion is about. So let's see how Rav Huna proves his point. So when he says you have to bodkin lemizono, when he says you have to check to see if really someone's eligible for food but not for clothes, he says, e bayit ema kra, Rav Huna offers two sources for the ruling. If you wish to say that my ruling is established by a biblical verse, making it, what, d'oraita, or very biblically anchored, the e bayit ema svara, or you could say that I have to bring you a rational argument. I'm going to bring you back up in the world of rabbinic culture. Savara is a little bit less founded than a biblical proof that's from Akra. If I am a Savara, let me give you this rational argument. Haika mibaze. This inadequately clothed applicant debases himself. Mibaze. Appearing before the charity administrators in what looks like woeful attire. And as it says in the idiomatic translation here, if he were not truly in need, he would not do so. Thus, there is no reason to investigate whether he owns proper clothing. V'ha lo kamet baze. And this other applicant does not debase himself merely claiming that he's hungry. Thus, the administrators must investigate whether he is telling the truth. Yeah, why not?
Well, you know, someone who has horrible clothing may have his good clothing over there. So he's coming to you in ripped clothing. You don't know. And does he debase himself? I don't know. I mean, it depends on what you think of poor people. I mean, if they're not dressed well or properly, you know, they're not their fault. You don't criticize them for that.
What we're concerned about is sort of the person who is lying to, or, you know, is effectively a criminal and a thief. Well, if I want to commit a crime, then in order to commit my crime successfully, I have to put on some crummy old clothes. I don't think that that's a good test for whether someone really needs it, you know, intends to defraud the system. Unless...
Yeah, I think you have to understand the culture. If it's so stigmatizing to not have good clothes, then presumably it would be very unlikely that somebody would try to defraud by appearing in public in clothing that would make them...
Well, it's more than the public. It's appearing before the administrator who throws out which is apparently a big deal.
So. It may be that there was a different kind of social unacceptability of not looking, you know, your best. I mean, that could be who you are, is the way you present yourself. And it's more embarrassing than it would be for us for someone to do that. I agree with you. If you really want to get the money, you could, you know, just put on other clothes. But apparently it says how they don't consider it.
You're only going to get clothing, though.
Right. So. But I'm not sure what's embarrassing about being... If it's embarrassing to be seen in tattered clothing because it's indicative that you're poor, going in and saying, I'm hungry, has that same negative...
publicly obvious, though. So it's not the same.
Clothing is cool today. Everybody walks around with torn pants.
Right. that's the argument for it. In every milieu, there is a different kind of level of this clothing, this nature of clothing. You do have to see the rabbis as being concerned that someone does present themselves in at least a modest way with the right robe. People generally did not have a lot of clothing back in this time. They were sometimes lucky if they even had one outer garment that was properly laundered on a routine basis. Now, they were really well off if they had two plus a Shabbos garment. The rabbis tried to say about this outer garment that he's walking around in that you should have one garment for the weekday and one garment for Shabbos. That's part of what the whole clothing piece is here in this discussion. So it's very important to understand their milieu.
But if they said, I need clothing because I can't serve Shabbos properly. I don't have anything to wear for Shabbos. That's not what they're saying.
Well, what he's saying, though, is in a certain way that I am willing to appear in court here before this
shabbily.
Court and dressed in this fashion.
Are you agreeing with Bobby then that we're missing the cultural?
I think there is an argument to be made that Rav Huna believes that culturally this guy wouldn't do it.
So culturally, looking is more important than giving them clothing is more, you know, less controversial, actually, than providing food for them because you don't have to...
Providing money for food.
Yeah,
but he's only asking for clothing. He's not asking for money.
Right, and that seems to me, you know...
So, I guess clothing is partially fungible, but not...
By the way, let's listen to what Rav Yehuda says, because there's going to be the...
I'm just saying that it's an indication of the relative embarrassment or humbling that not being nicely dressed means for them, if that's the way you could turn. Personally, I think if someone's hungry, you give them something to eat. And, you know, I don't think there's a question, but I think the fact that they make this argument is an indication of how it must be a different value system.
Right, but we just, what you said before is that now we're going to learn the opposite.
Correct.
All right, so...
So right.
It's
so listen and hold out what the different arguments are, because you can really go either way at this moment. But Rav Huna does believe, with what Bobby and Barry are saying, you know, it's good. You two should. You have the
we'll
right.
Go shopping together.
Yeah, exactly. You have the right. You have the. That's Rav Huna's sense.
Giving out bow ties.
you have that sense from Rav Huna that he believes that no one would do this. But with Mizonot and asking for the money for it from the charity pot, then I'm a little worried. Here's the pasuk that he brings, Ibayde Makra, and if you will, I'll teach you this lesson to you from a verse. That's another way of saying the Ibayde Makra. Literally, it means, if you want to, I'll say, with a verse, in other words. So, if you will, I'll also teach you not just from a rational perspective that he would never embarrass himself like that. Halo faros lora'ev lachmecha. Will you not break your bread for the hungry? Beshin kativ. In other words, this word faros is not written thros with a samech. It's written faros, which is the root, whether you have a sin or a shin, it doesn't make a difference because sin and shin are really interchangeable. And if I have that root, and that's what the Bible says, I know it's indicating that I need to, if homophonically, it sounds like lifros, that is to spread out, or to immediately give out slices, or to have a prusat lechem, or to have a slice of bread. If it changes that word to fros with a sin, and doesn't use the samech, then I can learn something from that, and that is, I need to lifaresh, I need to use that root of that verb, as it is used in a different verb form, and I need to put it in the verb form piel and not kal, for those grammar buffs around. Mm-hmm. I need to say it's not lifros, it's lifaresh. And by putting it in that different verb formulation, I then say to myself, I have to make a perush, I have to have commentary, I have to have an investigation on this poor person who's asking me for the bread that the verse refers to. Because the bread is what's referred to in terms of the hungry people. V'hadar havle, and then give him food if he's deserving. V'hatam kativ, and with regard to those who lack adequate clothing, it's written in a different place, which is in Isaiah, ki tirei arom v'chisito, when you see the naked, you shall cover him. Ki tirei la'altar. The verse implies that clothing should be provided when you see him. That is, immediately upon his asking. And therefore, if I have to, by Isaiah's teaching, clothe the naked immediately, or clothe the one who's in tattered, shabby shmatas immediately, then I'm left with what's going to be a system where I check for food disbursements, cash from, what do we call that? The tamchui, the soup kitchen fund. And I don't check for the dispersal of clothing. Now, what does this assume the charity administrators have at their disposal? So we didn't say that yet.
Clothes.
Can I just ask for a clarification? Because the Schottenstein language is filling in something. The verb here, soaked, is to cover. And I'm unclear as to whether we know for a fact that the Gemara is speaking about somebody whose clothing is torn, and in that respect we would say in English, inadequately clothed, or are we talking about somebody who is exposed to the point that it would be humiliating and that they're not fully covered?
That's a good question. The Gemara seems to be indicating that we're talking about somebody who has an outer garment, would not really come. I don't think that the Isaiah Pasuk is the informative Pasuk.
Oh,
is the verse that informs, right? So if we learn from Isaiah that it's really about someone naked, I don't think that's it. I do think what it is it's that you have, let's say, in those times, and this is a very rudimentary understanding of it, based on the fact that we don't have any kind of diaries about or log books about these conversations at the Charity Administration Center. But fundamentally what it meant was that an outer garment could be stained. What we know from the Gemara itself, an outer garment could be stained. A Talmid Chacham, a sage, does not wear a stained garment. This is, affirmatively we know, the rabbis are embarrassed about stains on garments. And so if you want to fit into Jewish culture, you really shouldn't wear a stained garment if you want to be like the Chachamim. And so, from what they say about clothing, we have to work backwards to really answer your question. So that's in Shabbat, Gemara Shabbat. We also know about clothing that from Gemara Brachot, right from the first Gemara we would read if we were kind of quote-unquote going in order, is that we want to wear a garment that has four corners, and we want to have fringes on them. And Jews wore fringes in this era with specific ways of tying tzitziot. And the important thing was to have those four corners so that you could wear tzitziot. And in general, that kisui, that was a lot of fabric. And the fabric probably was your overgarment on a daily basis. There was no such thing as this talit tatan that I can buy with t-shirt material now and wear my tzitzit tucked in nicely, and one with mesh for the summer so that it breathes easy on my body. I mean, all these things are available now. You know, halachic technology companies are really doing it right for kids at camp and for adults, discerning adults. So it probably, in my estimation, would mean that someone comes in this tattered outer garment. He's still got tzitzit, they're probably soiled. And I can see a picture of him, and he's probably even got certain parts that are worn down to the point where it looks like you can see through the linen or the flax. You could see through the kind of garment that he's got going, or he's got tears, but that he's pretty tidied up underneath in terms of the administrative presentation that he's going to make. I don't see a naked soul.
I didn't mean actually naked, because I...
No, I realize that, but I'm going to the extreme. I do have to say, it's not someone who just wants to expand his or her garment collection. Now, here's where I might, you know, we were writing one of these ancient fiction kind of novels. Could you imagine one of the Chachamim, who's a very impoverished soul, going to the Tzedakah administration and saying, I'd like to live out this halacha. Could you please provide for me the second garment I need so that I could have one for a weekday and one for Shabbos? I could actually hear that conversation from what I know from the text. And we could weave that nice fictional piece or recreation of sorts from the texts we know about garments and what is said about garments in the Gemara.
I'm surprised they didn't go to the text that you have to return the outer garment to someone who's given it to you as collateral before the sunset.
Oh, that's very nice. Barry's bringing up a Deuteronomy source that talks about if you're holding somebody's outer garment as collateral for their work and ultimately they come and you're not allowed to keep it overnight. I like that a lot. That seems to me a very contemporary way of thinking about the Talmudic passage, like my teacher, Rabbi Dr. Aryeh Cohen, did in terms of this section which we've read from, his article, because there's a justice issue in here. I'm not sure they brought that within the Gemara text itself that we were learning.
Is there any consideration of, like, being cold and needing an outer garment? Because they have,
I think a part of the whole reason why these systems exist is because it does get cold. It's like if you go to Jerusalem in the wintry times, not everywhere is the negative, definitely. Let's look at Rabbi Yehuda and think about the reverse. Rabbi Yehuda Amar, here's what Rabbi Yehuda says, though. Amar bodkin lichsut. You're going to check it out for clothing. V'ein bodkin limizonot. But we don't investigate the eligibility of a pauper that asks for food. So Rashi again adds about this. Ein bodkin. Ein bodkin lichsut. Ba erum. Now here, Jay, I'm going to turn the tables on you. Because Rabbi Yehuda's case is different than Rabbi Huna's case. So now it's good. He comes naked. V'amar kisuni lokhin kisut miyad. You what? Lokhin? You take a cover and immediately cover him up. Now does that mean, quote unquote, take the shirt off your own back? Not sure what the verb there for Rashi is really doing, the lokhin verb, but it sounds like it. Because I know this phrase in English, take your shirt off your back, you know, take the shirt off your own back. So I have to be careful. You know, am I reading back into what Rashi's saying based on this little quip that I know? But somehow he's saying immediately deal with the... Okay. Rabbi Yehuda offers two sources for his ruling. He's going to use the same system. I'll give you one source that seems like a rational argument for this argument, my way of thinking about it, and I'm going to also provide a biblical source for it. This one who asks for food is possibly suffering the pangs of hunger, as some of us, we can see both of these, by the way, so not some and some. We see both. But this one whose hunger pangs are really right there in front of my face, I there's no way I can start the whole check it out process. And we should not prolong his suffering while we verify his claim. V'hai lo kametzara le. But this one who requests clothing doesn't suffer physically. Hence, he's got to wait while we authenticate the claim. Now, if you look at the footnote 18, the Ritva is Rishon, and he's kind of summarized there. The Gemara speaks of a case where the supplicant appears in clothing that is sufficient to protect him from the cold, for if not, he too qualifies as one who suffers from his poverty, and the administrators would be required to provide him with the warm clothing immediately. Rather, this supplicant is merely embarrassed and debased by the inappropriateness of his attire. So you got these people who have lots of layers, right, who have ultimately lots of layers, and you have enough clothing. So does Ritva agree with Rashi's read that he came naked and he's standing there and he needs clothing? No. He's thinking that it's time of cold weather, the Ritva, and this guy, even though he seems to have enough clothing, really looks like he's in shmatas. Rabbi Yehuda advances the scriptural source. E bayit emakra. Let's go with the biblical reasoning now. Hacha kativ. Here, regarding one who requests food, it's written this. How low, look at it. You have to physically look at it now, because it's going to be different. He's going to change the actual letters in the word that is generally, according to the Masoretic system, that is the Masoretes who wrote the official kind of codex from which we write our Tanakh, we write our Torahs, and we write our entire Jewish Bibles, which does have the sin for halo faros lorayev lachmecha. He writes it like this. It's written, halo faros lora'ev lachmecha. He even says, in writing, you can change the sin with the samech. And you can use this verb that seems like immediately, hand the guy a piece of bread. Right? Because anytime I have that verb faros, I immediately want to see that verb at work. A slice. Prusat lechem.
But we're talking about money.
But are we talking about money?
Well,
because
are we?
Well, the verse is talking about
bread.
You are hungry, should get bread.
Right.
Lach
right.
Now, they are using that verse to make an argument about the money in the charity fund. So they're equating money to bread in that way. And therefore, if I really have a couple dollars in my pocket, and I'm trying to be so discerning when somebody walks up to me on the streets of New York and says, can you help me out with some food? If I thought about my money as being like three slices of bread, then I should, if that's my outlook on my money, immediately give it to them. Maybe that's what the whole, again, I'm saying for the people who are making the policies and have to live with these things, maybe there are some lessons in here. But if I really don't think about my money in that sense, that money can go elsewhere, and really that could be really trip people up. But I really believe that anyone who would come and say, I'm really cold tonight, would I, for the 3 blocks I have to walk, take my coat off my back and give it to them? I think that, you know, you're kind of challenged here between the good and the good, by the way. And you're challenged in how you personally might relate if you're confronted on a very personal level by these individuals. What we're talking about here is a policy level of the charity administrators who have to come up with an answer as to whether or not they're going to be immediately releasing all these funds and sources of tikkun, of fixing the world through this development, immediately, or they're going to come up with something else. And when it comes to breaking your bread with the hungry, Rabbi Yehuda is at least saying you got to do it right immediately. And for arguing that you can actually have a check-it-out system, a eligibility system provision, when it comes to the clothing, he says, Hatam Ketiv, ki tire arom v'chisito, when you see the naked, you shall cover him, which, by the way, is the same verse, right, and written even the same way. We're not talking about some kind of change in letters here. But he interprets that verse differently than Rav Huna did. Whereas Rav Huna said, that's immediately. He says, oh, k'she yera'e lecha, since it says ki terei arom, when it is apparent to you versus when you see him, he changes tirei to a different verb form from an active you shall see him to a passive it shall be made apparent to you, going from what's called the kal binyan to the nifal binyan, an active verb pattern to a passive verb pattern, then and only then are you able to actually provide clothing. Again, you could make lots of arguments for these things. The clothing's very expensive. Tailors have to work very much so on making sure it's fit to the person. Obviously, we're interested in seeing if it fits. Maybe we have garments in different sizes, so we have a number of them at our disposal, but we can't give these away indiscriminately. So the Gemara actually comes and is going to chime in. Tanya kavatei de Rav Yehuda. We have a braita like Rav Yehuda. Ah, so the braita, we know, is a source that's from the time of the Mishnah, and it's going to lend a lot of credence to this latter position, Rav Yehuda's position. And remember, the Gemara editors didn't have to write this in here. The Gemara doesn't have to present this as the picking between one or the other. But here's what the Gemara is going to say, and then we can figure out who's we like more, or which we feel deserves more eligibility checking more, or if we feel that both are being argued for as I recommend it. But the Gemara says, it was taught in a braita like the opinion of Rav Yehuda, Tanya Kavatei, the Rav Yehuda, Amar Kasuni, if a pauper comes and says, clothe me, Bodkin Acharav, we investigate him, Parnasuni, if however he says, provide me with sustenance, meaning for meals, Ein Bodkin, we don't investigate, period. The braita didn't have all of the reasoning. The braita didn't try to bring any reasoning. The braita didn't say, I have one reasoning that's a rational reasoning, and I have another way to prove it to you from a pasuk. By the way, in the sense that they're arguing about this, maybe they're arguing, having learned the braita, with absolutely no reasoning behind it. They're interested to know, like, why would the braita be presented that way? The braita didn't come at the beginning of the argument here. The braita came after the argument. Now I can kind of understand, though, maybe why there was a discussion at all between these two sages, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda, about the whole issue, because it seems like there's a braita that wanted to take a position that you have to check by one and you don't have to check by the other. So that is a possibility, kind of the reverse way that sometimes the Gemara starts a discussion with a braita at the outset and then chiluk deot, differentiation of opinions afterwards. just a different feature of the literature here. So that leaves us with Rav Yehuda feeling like he's got a little bit of backup, Rav Huna not feeling so backed up, and where does it leave us? What do you think? Do we need systems to check for eligibility at the Tzedakah administration Beit Din?
It's nice to say that in theory you don't, but if you have limited resources to help the poor, you want to try to do what you can to help the people who need the help. Whether you want to call it an investigation or whatever, but
it's the immediacy that also has to be factored. There's an immediate need. Chances are you have to have less investigation than if it's a chronic ongoing commitment that's going to be extending out in time.
But it's hard to say one, investigate one, don't investigate the other. It seems like the arguments are 50-50. So then it becomes not like, do you really need to investigate? If the community values in general are so strong, and there's not the kind of diversity we have in our society today, I'm wondering whether, does it really make, I think they're making the argument that you need to investigate something. But I'm wondering whether you really need to do that. If people are really debased by asking for help, if that's what's really happening, not just like looking like I need help or saying that I'm hungry, but just to ask is a form of debasement. Do you really need to, if the values are strong enough, do you really need to investigate that? I don't know.
Good.
Well, I think what Barry said is right. The immediacy, if you're wrong on the food issue, the consequences could be disastrous. The guy could starve to death. And so there's really no time to investigate that kind of a claim. Clothing is not as immediate.
But on a cold night, you can die faster from not having warmth than you can from not having enough food.
Okay, now we're tough. Which gets to my question, which is, what about housing? Do they have no homelessness? I mean, third on the list here.
Right.
Do you have a place to sleep?
No. So they absolutely do. They absolutely relate to it in another passage in the Gemara when it comes to giving a person a place to sleep. We actually went to a Mishnah. Remember, we went and turned to the Mishnah in Peah about the ones who go door to door. And the person who says, I need food, right? And so extended from those discussions are cases about whether or not someone absolutely needs to come in from the cold, and whether or not someone needs a place for a Shabbos, and what obligations a community would have to do that. So, yes, it's here, and it's not as systematized as we would think of needing if we were building a shelter system for the city of New York. But it's definitely here in terms of if a discussion is to lead us to think about policy, what we ought to be thinking about. So it's not ignoring that while it's talking about these things. So that's a good question, though. Like, why not enter it into here? Let's see what they really need. What of the shelter notion? Yeah?
I also wonder whether, based on what community life was like at that point in time, when you're talking about a smaller community, people, you don't need to do so much investigation for the simple reason that people know who the people
right.
are who are in need. And
right.
if you know that this person has a problem and they come in every week because they need a little bit of extra money for food, you don't need to investigate.
Right. So one issue with the text here, which was going to be one of my pieces to suggest, is that, remember we had a little bit of discussion previously about whether or not it's someone who is known and it's someone who's not? So I think a piece of this is about presenting yourself as quote-unquote a known player and really what you're trying to ask. So I think you can make that argument stronger at exactly the way you're making it based on the fact that this text referred to that once in pages, you know, eight or nine, and we're not so far from the beginning where we started on 7b, right? But so that's in here in my estimation. That what do we trust more, knowing the general pool of folks who are really here? We have the notion that people are passers through in the text as well, and that we do have to take care of them in some way, shape, or form. We're just not exactly sure that every courtyard has to be the spot they go. That's why we might have to have this central administration, and therefore, Jews. Then, if I know that a courtyard doesn't have to open themselves up to these passers-by, these passers-through, then my argument is not as solid in terms of this being the spot where the known folks come. Then my argument is, oh, there are X number of people here who know we as a community are set up with these resources for if they need it, they shall be within our gates. And the tzedakah administration indeed may have to deal with some of the more known players, but in fact is the address for the less known ones, because those passers-by are not necessarily people we have an obligation towards in our small courtyard, where we're actually going to give a plate of food, or we're going to provide for some lodging, or things like this. So it depends on how this whole system actually pans out within what neighborhood, within what municipality we're talking about. So you can go both ways, I think.
So what would the investigation actually say?
Well, that's a good question, right? It's a really good question. I think policy-wise, so here's my estimation. It is suggesting that you could do investigations that provide for guarding the dignity of either of these folks, who says he's hungry and who says I need clothing. And I think that those are really serious questions within society that certain systems administrators have to really figure out. You know, I'll use the Common Pantry again. I'll use Project Aura, for whom we're raising tzedakah for the Super Bowl party. You know, please be generous. These folks spend a lot of time thinking through systems and rethinking systems. You know, the only kosher Meals on Wheels to get people the lachmecha, the bread in their hands, have to really figure out how they're doing this and to whom they're really providing. They have caseworkers. They only had some caseworkers inside the second floor of the new Educational Alliance building. Now they have people who go out. And by the way, when they're out there, they've been trained in hoarding and recognizing what hoarding looks like. Just haven't been involved in a few of the internal discussions over there myself, being privy to it. It's really unbelievable the kind of system they have for really determining whether or not someone is absolutely hungry and in need of an infusion of physical groceries, or they have a bank account and they're managing with that bank account, and whether or not it should be that they have or have not applied to SNAP, which is the new version of the food stamp program in America, and can we get them on the delivery system from this and or that place? Those are really incredible people. The New York Cares folks, to whom we deliver the coats and who help distribute them within the shelter system of New York, and the NCS, the National Coalition for Homelessness and Shelters, who runs the shelter here that we've been associated with as a synagogue for many years, we had a meeting with them, with the Chesed Committee had a meeting with them, and we asked, what is it exactly you need? What are people really asking for? And they said, they're asking for coats. I mean, you guys bring dinner once a month after week four because SNAP runs out for most of those residents over there. But they also are asking for coats. And by the way, I said, so, okay, they're asking for coats. We have a standard coat drive, and we could do some local delivery versus just giving to the big campaign. Let me ask you further. What else are you really saying about those clothing needs? Ah, we figured out that they need 60% of those people who need are extra larges. And commentary on health and the like. But they needed them. And so we did a little bit of our investigating. Is the investigation proactive on behalf of the administration so that the next time that person walks in the door, there's no embarrassment whatsoever and they just hand over the check. That, to me, or this Gemara, if you will, helps, I think, turn our wheels and as caring souls, as Jews in the world, has us start thinking with these agencies, how do we do this? How do we build in systems of eligibility criteria that can get us to the place where perhaps what's ideal here, what feels ideal here for us, is an immediate resolution of someone's crisis, right? So that, to me, as the reader, as the someone who has, thank God, enough to think about helping provide with my own tzedakah, with, thank God, our community's tzedakah, as part of a, if you will, advisory board or someone who sits with some of these folks, I am inspired through a discussion like this in the Gemara to say, how can I be helping think about the systems that are out there proactively so that we can get to the immediate response of, here's what you need. Because if I put the wall up when someone walks through the door of the soup kitchen or through the door of Project Or, or through the door of the Upper East Side and they're on the street and they ask me for X, Y, or Z, if I have to put that wall up first, there's something that I'm just not fulfilling by way of either of these verses interpreted in the proactive way that either of these Rebbe's, Rav Huna or Rav Yehuda, is suggesting. That is, oh, so maybe there is a way to see these verses as you're needing to do this immediately. By the way, do I every time respond to somebody asking me on the street, I'm homeless, I'm hungry, give me money? No, I don't. I don't. Sometimes do I carry a little bit of extra food from wherever I was and hand it off and say, I don't know, would you like a package of this? Would you like a package of that? I try more and more because I see more and more people in our neighborhood. Oh, they're very thankful. I think it depends, because
which is a test.
I'm willing to do like something that with a little nourishment and something that's a little bit savory and salty and junky. Like a package of oats and honey granola bars, a package of peanut butter granola bars, or a pan of Lance little crackers with cheddar cheese. So sometimes I'll order those things. They'll say, like, Rabbi Bolton, what are you? How many snacks are you eating in your office?
Be careful about the peanut allergy.
No, that's right. That's right. I am. But and by the way, some of them I say, are you allergic to anything? And they look at me like, are you actually stopping to talk to me about an allergy? But and sometimes they'll eat Jewish food that they never even knew from Jewish food. Like, we'll have gefilte fish left
I'm
over here.
I'm not walking around with shawarma.
But gefilte fish and horseradish after a kiddush, if I'm the last one out, to someone... Absolutely. And wouldn't you know, like, one guy, one time I did it, one guy's like, gefilte fish. Oh, man, do I love gefilte fish. I'm not even going to ask.
What happens to our excess food when we have a kiddush?
Well, if you have it completely sealed here, which we try to leave, if we have a lot of food at a big kiddush, we leave certain things sealed. Because I know that the next day or two or three, because when I first got here, we figured this out. Richard Staden and I, with Harvey when he was here, figured out that they would take deliveries at either the Neighborhood Coalition Shelter or the Common Pantry, of sealed, wrapped trays. So like a tray of macaroni and cheese, we know we can deliver it somewhere.
What about the uneaten food that's exposed?
There's really nothing you can do with that, especially...
No, we do it for for morning kiddush.
Yeah, so what happens with a bowl of tuna, a bowl of egg salad, a bowl of this, a bowl of that, they oftentimes will go to the morning kiddush. We, so some people in the building will have a little lunch, a meeting will come, we'll put something on. We could say we're getting better and better and better at understanding, because we've been charting it over the last 2.5 years, the numbers of people that come to different services in Kiddushim. depending on time of year with vacation and people in and out of town, and we're doing, so we're trying. We're trying to be responsible. If that is in the meta level helpful to, you know, kind of being able to put some other resources towards these other efforts that we've got to go buy coats or to go buy some food or to provide for the common pantry tzedakah, I definitely take that seriously as an overall piece of what we do here. And that's a discussion that happens at Thursday kind of meetings within what we're really looking at, because so much of our activity in the shul has food and has expenditure on that kind of thing. But getting back to the detail here, I feel an obligation and I feel a privilege to sit with some of these folks to do whatever part I can to help think about systems if they need that. The common pantry went to Toyota Motor Corporation to actually systematize in such a way that completely dignifies the clients or friends' experience within the building. Choice on an iPad, take an order, the grocery bag is filled with fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, and whatever else can be donated or purchased with at a great rate. These kinds of things are so important. The SNAP program, if a person is homebound and can't go out and spend, those provisions are so much different than what your average grocery store packaged food looks like and tastes like. That we have to remember that too if we're trying to really dignify it. And so we're trying to add a bag of groceries now through the common pantry to anybody who gets the deliveries of their SNAP groceries, as opposed to having them come into the common pantry food shelter. That is because at a meeting with the executive director, with their development person who's interested in tzedakah outright, and himself and one other person from the organization, having talked about these things within our chesed committee, I could bring back ideas to them to say, well, what if we can make that happen? So that's where I think this Gemara goes. That's the system. That's a big answer to, Jay, your question.
I meant then.
Then, I think it looks like a little bit of taking the person aside and asking a few questions and making sure that we feel okay and right about spending the community's money at this moment. I don't think there's anything. Yeah, I don't think there's anything much more that they could have done. But I'm not an expert on administrative charitable distribution law. We don't seem to have a lot of it. Let's put it this way: there's not a massive amount of beyond these pages, a massive amount of literature, codific literature or agadic literature, on how that works. There are commentaries on it, by the way. So I'll tell you the one commentary. Rabbi Hillel's wife is cooking for Shabbat, and it's a Friday. And comes to the door, people asking for a little bit to eat. And Hillel's kind of doing a couple of questions, two or three. Where are you coming from? Who are you? The wife overhears their request for a little bit of something, and she comes out with some of the soup and sends them away, and sends them off, after inviting them in for Shabbat. Yep. That's the kind of agadic commentary, at least for a chacham at his door, because maybe the poor knew the address of the great Rabbi Akiva. Right. So maybe I should have a little something. And his wife is the one to teach the lesson, according to the text.
Your big answer was wonderful, by the way.
No. I hear you.
Can I add a little aside? I don't want to take too long, but I saw a terrific documentary film that I think was called No Room at the Table. Hmm. And it was about what they call is insecurity. Insecurity is the phrase for
right.
people not getting. And it was... documentary about a town in the Midwest, and the ones that were responsive were the churches, and what they would do, I remember they focused on this little girl who did not have enough in her family. They had lost jobs and they were all living together, extended family and everything, And the teacher, towards the end of this food stamp period, would leave packages of fresh food on the door once she knew the family was out, so that they could save face and they weren't confronting anybody in person. And she was doing it. But the kind of food, I mean, there's all kinds of issues in terms of the kind of food available, the kind of food that they get with the food stamps.
Right.
You know, it was like one thing was compounded by another. But I did remember clearly this trying to give them dignity by just leaving the package on the doorknob when no one was home, the teacher knew. And the teacher was particularly sensitive to this little girl because she herself grew up in a family that didn't have enough food, and she was now the teacher in the school. It was very touching, but there were so many, you know, complicating factors in terms of how to do it with dignity and how to do it in a helpful way. And it wasn't just giving the money. It was actually giving the food itself to make sure that people really did get food. Mm. But it wasn't the best kind of food. So,
right.
And a lot of, you know, comfort habits and comfort food. So it's complicated to solve.
Right. Agreed. Agreed. Okay. Keep in mind what Bobby just said about what's the best way to do it, because, yes, we're going to get to one of the policy discussion questions about what's the best way to do it, vis-a-vis do I have to do it anonymously or not. Okay? We've talked about that before. But the other thing we've mentioned, if you turn to 9A3 in the packet, the other thing we mentioned at one point was, wait a minute, aren't we just talking about the tax, and doesn't that tax for contributing to the community go back to the half-shekel contribution that everybody made to the Mishkan? Okay? So 9A3, towards the bottom of the right-hand column, the Gemara establishes minimum annual charity contribution. Here we go. Amar Rav Asi. Ravasi says, "Le'olam al yimna adam atzmo," in other words, milatate, "shlishit ha-shekel v'shana." A person should never restrain himself from donating to charity at least one-third of a shekel each year. Now, one-third of a shekel might be a little less than the major amount of money that the Rambam suggests is the general amount that people should give in terms of gifts to the poor each year. Because what the Rambam says is that it gets down to that it's a tenth of everybody's income. It's 10%. But a shlish of a shekel here, third of a shekel, seems to be the minimum amount. So yes, there's a minimum. So maybe that means that there's a maximum when Rambam suggests it's 10%. Well, the maximum said by the rabbis is a little bit different than a percentage, and that is, one should not give charity to the point where one becomes in need of charity him or herself. Okay. Shenemar, as it said, Ve'he'emadnu aleinu mitzvot, latet aleinu shlishit ha-shekel v'shana la'avodah b'ed Eloheinu. For it stated, and we took upon ourselves commandments, this is said in Nehemiah, when they were rebuilding the temple in the land of Israel, we took upon ourselves commandments to give ourselves one-third of a shekel each year for the work of the house of our God. So what does that mean? Does that mean that it's giving one-third of a shekel instead of giving one-half of a shekel? Well, if I say that in the days of Nehemiah, the third of a shekel is just like the half a shekel that were in the days of Moses, then I have a really nice-sounding Talmudic argument, right? And I can say that I'm dealing with the same amount, and therefore that's why they said the third. That's if they were trying to fulfill what? The half-shekel requirement.
Upkeep.
For the whatever that fund was, let's say. For the upkeep, they thought that the half-shekel was for the upkeep, and therefore that's what they're providing. But if I didn't think that I was trying to actually fulfill the half-shekel requirement, but I was now taking on, in terms of the requirement is fulfilled by my half-shekel contribution, but I was now donating to the charitable funds that are necessary for the maintenance and upkeep. In other words, I've got my dues, but I've also got my kol nidre. That's what could be interpreted here with the third of a shekel. Turn. Ravasi interprets the verse homiletically. Amar Ravasi. Ravasi says, Shkula tzedaka keneged kol ha-mitzvot. The commandment of giving charity is equal to all the other commandments combined. Shneemar, as it said, ve'he'emadnu aleinu mitzvot v'chule. And we took upon ourselves commandments. The mitzvah ein kativ kan. Mitzvah, a commandment, is not written here. Ela mitzvot, rather the plural commandments, is written to teach that the mitzvah of charity and contributing that way is equivalent to all the other mitzvot. Nice. So you have this notion of actually taking on the notion, the fulfillment of tzedakah through this giving into a fund that does more and suffices to say not only more to upkeep the house of the Lord, but also to provide for those who are coming to the house of the Lord with needs. Let's say it's all inclusive that way. And therefore, I could say that mitzvah is keneged kulam, is equal to them all. And I've really fulfilled so much of the Torah through this giving. That's one way to look at it. It's equal to them all. I don't think, right, so does that mean we don't have to do anything but give charity? Well, there's lots of times when, I'll just say yes. No, but see, it's that easy for the rabbi sometimes.
What? Say that again?
They say, do
if
this.
If you give a third shekel.
If you contribute to the funds.
Right.
For the upkeep of the house, their temple, our synagogue, right? Then you're doing fine. Well, can we really say that?
And you're saying that if you do that, then you don't have to give charity.
I'm saying that that's the rabbi seems to be saying is that's equal to them all.
Oh.
And, so I was making a joke. So do we say yes? Do we say yes? Sometimes we do say yes by way of it is a way for people to connect to their Jewish lives, to give a little bit of tzedakah to the UJA, to give a little tzedakah to the synagogue. Right? And we say, that stands as a way of your being, and this is the different way to read Keneged. I'll make a different read. Not that it was equal to all of the other mitzvot and you have nothing else to do, but that's kind of like your doorway in. Now standing before you is all your opportunity to make for a righteous life full of mitzvot as the mitzvah that you just performed. Through this charitable gift.
Big stretch.
Ah, it is a big stretch, but that's what the rabbis generally mean. Because the rabbis say it so often that that's what they have to mean. Talmud Torah keneged kulam. The mitzvah of learning is equal to them all. Does that mean if I learn one pasuk, one page of Gemara, I have no more mitzvot to do? Can't mean that. It means that when you learn a page of Gemara, and when you really are involved, then it is an invitation. What stands before you is the palette of all the other mitzvot that are possible now that you've enriched your life here and now that you've fulfilled this here. Move to a place where all the other mitzvot are also part of your delight. So that's what I think the rabbis, because they say it not only about tzedakah, they say it not only about Talmud Torah. And through the ages, Kabbalists, for instance, will say, I'm doing this mitzvah with full intentionality, as if I performed all 613 of your mitzvot, God. So that trope, that one mitzvah is all you need do, was never the understanding, and it came to poetic, kind of liturgical expression in the Kavanot of the mystics, who then said specifically, it says, if I did all the other 613 mitzvot, and by the way, why are they saying as if it's to say all the other 613 mitzvot? Because people generally like to have things in lists, and if I say 613, now you can really start to attach yourself to, okay, what was number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 420, because I'm doing 421. Right? So that's it's their push towards you living a life full of mitzvot. So giving charity and tzedakah should be an invitation to you for doing a lifetime and a life full of mitzvot. That's why I said yes. Okay, let's look now.
Let me push a little on this, because I think it's really important. Because, again, leaving our synagogue out altogether, but often the kavod in a community goes to the person who gives the most to the synagogue, irrespective of their other mitzvot. Hmm. That may not be the way the internal people respond, but in terms of the public recognition, the name on the this or that, it tracks with the money rather than mm-hmm. with the piety.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there is really a recognition of the need for resources and the tolerating this very obvious inconsistency relative to what I think most of us would judge as the summation of a person's religious responsibilities. Maybe say it that way.
Mm-hmm. But you use a word within what you said that I'll pick up on to say that I think discerning smart people probably feel the same way and just wouldn't say it as kindly. That there's a level of toleration for it. I mean, I do think that some people really feel themselves to be deserving of such, and I'll leave that aside for a minute. I do think sharing resources is a pretty big gesture, though, sometimes, for some people. And therefore, they just may need a little bit more of it to share those resources, which are so necessary. But I do think that discerning individuals, they somewhat tolerate it. There is a tolerance for it. And that they kind of say, well, if not for that, we wouldn't be the full house of mitzvot that we are. Right, but that doesn't mean that it's okay on the very individual level. We could say you've done tzedakah, therefore keneged kulam, you've done everything you need to do. Is the discussion sometimes, just to put it in a different sphere, there are lots of people who come to shul on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Right, those are their days of attachment, and I'm not sure that I've ever heard anyone say coming to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is keneged kulam, is equal to them all. But in the way we kind of see it, in my interpretation of the phrase, we could probably say it's keneged kulam. You've tasted it here, you've attached yourself to something that you feel is profoundly spiritually either meaningful, or you just feel it's necessary, or you do it because somebody else did it. And before you is all of the other possibility of what the community can offer if you want to engage it, right? Some will take you up on that, many will not. The rabbis are just looking for a way, I think, within their parlance, to always find a way to say to somebody who's found the one mitzvah that they can attach themselves to, that you've done well, and there's a whole world of other mitzvot that you could really get into here. So I can't imagine that they're just simply saying tolerate the one who gives tzedakah or celebrate the one who gives tzedakah and stop concerning yourself or the community with their participation in other mitzvot. I think what's happened in that sense on the liberal front, I'll give you an example of what goes on here, which is beautiful sometimes. Some people who have been really involved in big tzedakah life, and that's been their only attachment to mitzvot, sometimes will come and say to me, no one ever at a service asked if I wanted a late tefillin and had an extra set around in a liberal setting. right? Sometimes we're afraid to actually ask people to be involved in religious life who have these reputations and these kinds of places and status and stations in community because they've been involved on the tzedakah level. I love those moments. Those moments are just really unbelievable moments for some people when you're actually invited in a way that's, you know, kind of sweetening the potential. I think some people just don't feel like they should, you know, kind of stepping on eggshells, if you will, around those issues with folks, then breeds more of that in terms of what you observed. So we probably ought to rethink how we make those systems. I mean, or Zerua thought about how to remake that system. How do other people, quote-unquote, experience it the same way, as we kind of tolerate the status reality of those who are the greatest donors? Or is there another way to explain what we're talking about here?
I think we're blessed in our community. In fact, we have a lot of very generous people who don't require or request any level of recognition, financial givers. We've had people here who are not financial givers who have done small amounts of service for the show and have been offended at the fact that they weren't grandly recognized. So you get a mix of people. But when I was younger, I was very judgmental about people who gave lots of money and didn't involve themselves in the community. And as I grew up, I came to be not remotely judgmental about them, but fascinated by the fact that people who are not taking advantage of what the community offers, who are not involved frequently, nevertheless feel compelled to make sure the organization exist and who do donate very generously, and the people who come 1 or 2 days a year, I think they're missing out on a lot, but they need to be here. And I think that's fascinating, that there's still that hold on people who do not live Jewishly, at least in the sense of ritually or in terms of level of observance, maybe living out Jewish values in many other ways, but they still need that connection. So I don't think we tolerate it so much as we appreciate it. We don't necessarily know who those people are because they're not very public about it. I don't think in our community we tolerate it so much as recognize that there are different people give in different ways and different people take out in different ways. And this symbiotic relationship, there's an organic whole here, and I think we kind of get how it works.
I would say that's why, Barry, if you did, I think you said our community aside.
Right,
when,
yeah,
when
I,
you
I,
presented
I, at the beginning, I think you said our side,
I
but
did,
I...
because I think Ora Zerua is unusual in this.
Yeah, regard. Yeah, I would
there
agree.
There are definitely places where people want it to be known that they're big givers and whatnot. But I'm sure OZ may be unique, but I don't think it's unique in the sense that it's the only institution where people are simply not interested in making the point of the fact that they have money. We're aware of Jewish organizations where people want you to know that they have money. I'm sure there are Jewish, non-Jewish, and religious and non-religious institutions across the country, across the world, where you just get that kind of mix of people. So.
Yeah.
Well, I've been associated with other synagogues, excuse me, before I moved to the city, and even here, and I think Ora Zerua does less of that kind of recognition of the big givers than the others. I always knew who they were at these other institutions. I don't know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's my point.
Yeah. So that does. It kind of gets back to. Maybe we should go here. We'll skip the next little piece that I was going to go to, but let's go there. Let's go to 9b2, because now let's kind of reflect back on this big discussion that a lot of times we do really hear that anonymous giving is even more powerful. Forget that we're talking about the culture of celebrating the great tzadkanim of the world for a minute. Just what is if you're going to have a ranking system, we can say best. I think the rabbis would probably frame it as, what is the greatest way to fulfill the mitzvah of giving? Okay? Even though they're going to say what's greater than, what they're really asking is, what's the greatest way of fulfilling this mitzvah of giving? Okay? Pure giving. Because what that conversation that we started had, and this is a nice place to end tonight, because we have about 6-7 minutes, we'll get through some of the material here. What we started to say was that there was a fund that seemed like it was required. That was the half shekel. The text that was used was about the third shekel, and if you don't associate that third shekel with the half shekel, you're saying that you have to create other funds so that you have funds to do things that you need funds for, and we are talking about funds so far within our pages of Gemara that deal with feeding the hungry,
clothing
them, housing them when necessary, and also maintaining the spaces of the community, including the synagogue.
And safety.
Right. Safety, and that gets into the defense piece. So this discussion on the bottom of the right-hand column on 9b2 is talking about, so what's the greatest way to give to these funds? Rav Elazar says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Gadol ha'oseh tzedakah b'seter yoter mimoshe Rabbeinu. The one who performs charitable acts in secret, 9b2, right-hand side, on the bottom, towards the bottom. So one who performs charitable acts in secret is greater than Moses, our teacher. De'ilu b'Moshe Rabbeinu Kativ, because about Moshe, for about Moshe, it's written, Ki yagorti mipnei ha'af v'hachema, for I was in dread of the anger and the wrath. The ilu ba'ose tzedaka kativ, matan ba'seter yichpe af v'shochad b'cheik chema azah. A gift in secret pacifies anger, and a present in the bosom pacifies strong wrath. Thus, one who performs charitable deeds in secret can triumph over the very anger and wrath that Moses himself feared. And in this sense, he's greater than Moses. So this is an interesting kind of move back to giving being related to a theological kind of place, meaning that God may be angry with us and wrathful if we do not give enough tzedakah in our lives. Whether you want to have that stand as your particular motivation in terms of the charity you give, what is important to note is that the rabbis bring us to this place of saying that a giver of tzedakah for sure is making God aware of how you live your life, and also stands to lessen the severe decree, appease God's anger at the children not really living in the ways of God, Darkei Hashem, that if there are any reasons to be angry, if there are any reasons to hold the godly kind of grudge, if there are reasons to want to deliver punishment, that one can appease God and one can remove those potentials through the giving of tzedakah. And so for the rabbis, that's important. Now, they link that ability to impress the Lord with the giving done beseter, with the giving done anonymously, if you will, or in private or secretly. And so, you know, like you were talking about, Bobby, with this teacher who would secretly leave the package. Is that really it? Rabbi Yitzchak interprets the latter part of the verse differently, though. Uflige the Rabbi Yitzchak, the Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, af kofe, for Rabbi Yitzchak said, charity performed secretly will pacify anger. Chema eno kofe, but not wrath. Shneemar v'shochad b'cheik chemaza, and a present in the bosom strong wrath. Af al pi shochad b'cheik implies that although a present is in the bosom, even though charity was given in secret, Chemaza, the divine wrath remains strong. that he's just saying that divine wrath still remains strong. Anger is kind of this flaring up. Wrath is the deliverance of the punishment. There are those who say that Rabbi Yitzchak said a different interpretation. Kol dayan shenotel shochad mevi chema azal olam. Any judge that takes a bribe brings strong wrath to the world. Getting back to the notion that we could be talking about being informed about how to be better judges in terms of this whole tzedakah administration reality versus just talking about the individual who gives in private. Ah, shenemar v'shochad b'chek, as it's stated, in a bribe in the bosom, according to the version, the latter part of the verse does not concern the effects of charity, but the terrible consequences of accepting bribes. So, ultimately, that is the one spot where I have about giving anonymously. I've had a theological link to it in terms of anger and wrath. So if I recognize that they're saying that I'm greater than Moses, if I'm given secret, allows me to wipe away God's anger and wrath, I think a less theological way to understand what the rabbis are saying is that paupers who can easily get angry at a system that does not provide for them either the food or the clothing they need can in a certain way become very angry, just to put it in the terms of my locality. If I can't get what I need today because I can't navigate this system at all, and they find even the one spot to line up for a bowl of soup, the kind of emotional torment and rage and aggravation and even then behavior that manifests from that all will become more and more apparent if systemically we're not careful how we administer the tzedakah on levels where we provide food, shelter, and clothing. And perhaps I think the rabbis are creating this dialogue between what sounds like now we're talking about the charity fund administrators and now we're talking about individuals. Perhaps I need to really know what I make and feel about these approaches and questions in my individual life as much as the charity administrators need to know in terms of their lives as charity administrators. And the more I'm reflecting on these in terms of the Gemara that I learn for our milieu, where we can come to the table and bring these texts to bear on our mitzvah of tzedakah that we need, and the more in their time that the Gemara was able to show that there is some deliberation in terms of how both the tzedakah administrators and the individuals would fulfill what they felt was God's real request to give beyond that half shekel, having just read this essential passage that said in the days of Nehemiah they decided to take on that extra third, and that seemed like a minimum, that it's important that we really approach this with a consciousness deliberately. We may be able to in fact create the system that allows us to discern and define eligibility. And then if I walk out of the room, and it's not really about me as the judge or the administrator, but I secretly happen to give somebody something in private, then, by the way, you're greater than Moshe, your teacher. And we all want to achieve that in that sense. And it seems to me the rabbis are encouraging us, indeed, to find that potential in ourselves.
I think it's interesting, you know, I think it's interesting that it's really seen in the context of nullifying sin rather than a virtue in and of itself. And I guess it harkens back to High Holy Day organization, where we say, yeah, but prayer and charity nullifies. Ameliorate.
Right. The only thing I would say in response to that is that taken by itself and sitting on a parchment, and you know, if that was out of the greater context of the entire discussion here, I might say theologically, I have nowhere to then hang my hat if I want to use that discussion as, you know, kind of a, why did they go there in that moment on these pages of the Gemara? Right? Because a God relationship is a very individual relationship. And at the end of the day, the rabbis know that theology happens one-to-one-to-one-to-one. And Moses is an individual, one-to-one-to-one. And he's your Rebbe, just like he's my Rebbe. And there are, as I mentioned, tzedakah administrators being discussed here, and I believe limudim, lessons that relate to the individual in such a way that you don't only have to see it within the theological context that they've brought forward, you can see it within the context of you creating the relationship to God that you have and figure out how you're going to really approach this mitzvah. Him to you. Next week I will pick the highlights from the couple of pages we have left so that we can make a natural ending to our learning about tzedakah. And then let me encourage each of you to get your own volume of, or a shared volume in the family, of the last volume of the Schottenstein edition of Psachim. There are three volumes that make up tractate Passovers. And the last volume has the last chapter of the Masechet, which we will be studying together starting beginning of February.